Hello, welcome to The Rest is History, our latest bonus episode. Tom, you are poised and ready because this is a very big week for you and for us.
It is, because probably, guys, by the time you're listening to this, Dominic and I will have trod the boards of the Theatre Royal in Drury Lane in the very heart of London's glittering West End. And Dominic, when your theatrical career got sawn off at the knees and you were cruelly denied the chance to play Paddington, did you think that was it, that you would never star in the West End?
Yes, I think it's probably fair to say that my dreams of, you know, I'd seen myself very much as, Russell Crowe figure in Les Miserables, as Michael Crawford in The Phantom of the Opera, as Miss Trunchbull.
Okay, so those are the parts that you would go for. Because I thought that Paddington was what you were.
Well, I think I'd have done them after Paddington, actually.
Okay, so a bit like Hugh Grant, who plays kind of cheery, jovial kinds and then has taken a turn for the dark.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And then I'd have gone on a trajectory leading downhill till I was like kind of Brian Connolly appearing in the Grand Theatre all by himself in pantomimes.
Anyway, the point being that this is a big week for us because we're doing our first kind of major live Rest is History series. And we, by the time you hear this, we will have done the London show, which is at the Theatre Royal, where they're staging Frozen.
Yeah, we'll be on our way to Edinburgh, Tom, won't we?
Yes, we'll be sitting on a train.
To Edinburgh and then Salford, Manchester. Very controversial whether it's in Salford or in Manchester.
I don't think it is. I think it's in Salford.
Well, it is in Salford, but people in Salford get very cross when you say it's in Manchester. Anyway, that's by the by. It means nothing to our overseas listeners, so I don't know why we even embarked on that tangent.
Well, because we're excited.
Yeah, of course, we're very excited. We're very excited.
I really know we're excited.
But there's exciting things going on everywhere, Tom, because there's now on the Discord a Rest is History book club. We've been asked to give it a shout out. It is run by somebody called A Really Hot Fox.
Great name.
So they do a book every month and they get the author of the book on the Discord and they interview them. So I've done it. I believe you've done it, Tom.
I've done it twice.
Shockingly, they get people who are not presenters of The Rest is History, don't they?
I don't think that's not what the Discord is for.
We don't encourage that kind of behavior. So absolutely shouldn't do that again. But anyway, it's a brilliant thing. Congratulations to A Really Hot Fox for running it. All is sweetness and light at The Rest is History at the moment, isn't it, Tom? Because we had two lovely episodes last week.
Well, I wouldn't say lovely.
Well, I think they were lovely.
Oh, yes, I see. The ones that we recorded. Yes, yeah. They were very, Catcher and then Dogs.
We recorded the Marquis de Sade. When we said we were doing that in our live stream, there were loads of people on the live stream saying, oh, no, not the Marquis de Sade. I can't believe you're doing that. Please don't do that. I'm not going to listen to that. But actually, A, it's a very clean episode, or at least far cleaner than anyone would possibly have anticipated.
It begins with quite a dirty passage, doesn't it?
Yes, in every conceivable way. But there's very little. It's not as scatological or as pornographic as anybody would think. And it's quite a thoughtful episode, isn't it? Even if I say so myself.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yes, I hope so. Yes, I think the measure of thought has gone into it.
It's about the Enlightenment, about the French Revolution, and about Nietzsche. And
about the 20th century, about totalitarianism. Yeah, I think it's a good episode. So we commend it to you.
Yes.
I'm not sure when it's coming out, because we've got a hell of a lot of programs already recorded, haven't we? Stacked up.
Well, just when you were slow coming on, I was talking to the producers about our schedule and what a tangle it is, because we've got all our episodes. You've got the Oscar Wilde, you want to do Hadrian. We've got the US War of Independence. We've got Ireland. We've got all kinds of things. We're trying to jam them all into.
And Dominic, most importantly of all, we've got episodes that are promoting my two books that are out over the next few months.
Well, they're the ones that will possibly fall by the wayside, Tom.
So, very excitingly, my children's book, Rivaling You, about the girl who turns into a wolf during the Persian Wars. So that's coming out next week. We'll be doing two episodes in association with that, one on Herodotus and one on the birth of democracy. And then Pax, my super soar away new book on the Roman Empire, is out in July, and we'll be doing two episodes on the year of the four emperors, AD 69, for that.
So you say rivaling, Tom, but they're very different, aren't they?
Because they are very different.
Yes. I've taken delivery of your book, which is a very, very handsome thing, I have to say. Beautifully illustrated. It's lovely. It's a lovely looking book. I took it upstairs. It's currently in Arthur's bedroom. I have to say, at the bottom of a massive, seems to have got to the bottom of a massive pile. But that's the way with small boys' bedrooms, I think.
Yes.
Well, it's completely different from Adventures in Time, isn't it? Because it's so lavishly illustrated and it's kind of big format
as well.
But also,
it's a novel.
Yeah.
So all kinds of fantastical things are happening. The gods are there, Pan's appearing, Athena's appearing, Poseidon is destroying the Persian fleet, girls are turning into bears, boys are turning into wolves. all kinds of stuff, which you wouldn't get in Adventures in Time, would you? Because you don't have people turning into animals
in
that.
People are conquering Persia. People are carrying out human sacrifices. Churchill is rallying the nation. It's very rousing stuff, but people aren't turning into.
But mine is very rousing as well.
I believe you. I'm sure it is.
Battle of Marathon.
Yeah, very good.
Battle of Salamis.
Very good.
Stirring stuff.
Yeah. Very good.
So all to look forward to. So, so basically we've got lots and lots coming up.
Yeah.
Away from the episodes, you have been in Mexico. Do you want to just tell us about your highlights?
Sure.
So, because there's nothing people enjoy more than hearing someone talk about their holidays.
There isn't. And normally it would be unforgivable behavior, but
it's unfailingly interesting.
But I think what's so interesting about Mexico is that there are a few countries, I would say, that wear their history so close to the surface. So, think about countries that I visited, I would say, you know, the ones that stand out for sort of historical sites would be kind of Italy, Greece, Turkey, and Mexico is absolutely in that league. So I think at different levels. So one is the, obviously the archaeological sites, which I think are absolutely brilliant and easily the equal, if not far superior, frankly, to those in, let's say, Greece. Better maintained, more imposing. You know, the sort of great Zapotec citadel of Monte Albán in Oaxaca, which is commanding views of the valleys, the pyramids, all that sort of stuff. They are superb. But also what I found interesting, really interesting about it, were two other levels. So one is the conquest. We're going to do podcasts, again, for the purpose of self-publicity. We'll be doing some podcasts about the Cortes and the Spanish conquest, because that's the next adventure in time. And I found absolutely fascinating going and looking at all the Diego Rivera murals and things, and the depiction of the Spaniards and the sort of the tangled relationship that Mexicans have with their own history. Because of course they are the descendants of the Spaniards as much as they are of the indigenous people, of the Mexica or whoever.
Well, in some ways, I mean, their culture even more so. They're speaking Spanish, practicing Catholicism.
Yeah. But if you look at the depiction of the Spaniards, we've got one, I took a photo, one mural by David Siqueiros, which is in the sort of Palace of Fine Arts in Mexico City, this amazing building. And I'm going to use it in our live show, so a spoiler for those of you going to the live shows. And it shows the torture of Cuauhtémoc, the last Aztec emperor, by the Spaniards. And the Spaniards, you know, they look like the Nazis or something. They're such villains. And the fact that runs through so much of their public art, that Cortés always appears as this villain. I thought that was...
I remember the Diego Rivera frieze that shows Cortés, he's green and he's got the knobbly knees of a syphilitic. Yeah. I remember the guy telling me, I had no idea that syphilitics had knobbly knees. He looks awful. Yeah. I mean, he looks the essence of evil. Kind of a Marvel villain.
He always appears like that in those murals. And the one that I was just talking about, so La Malinche, who is the interpreter, who is arguably one of the most influential women of whom we know nothing in history, she's in the background in the corner of this mural, whispering, pouring poison into the Spaniard's ears.
Poison.
I loved all that sort of stuff. And the other stuff that I found, the other layer that I found so interesting was how, I mean, obviously all those murals were commissioned in the wake of the Mexican Revolution. An artistically really fascinating moment, because it created, it's the revolution that gives rise to Diego Rivera, to Frida Kahlo, to all the mural tradition and stuff. And the revolution, which is so little known, particularly in Europe, I mean, just might as well never have happened, is an immensely interesting story. You know, there are streets named after all the revolutionary leaders. There are districts of Mexico City named after, I don't know, Lázaro Cárdenas or Venustiano Carranza or Alvaro Obregón. So massive names, people who commanded vast armies.
I've never heard of them. I've never heard of them. So my knowledge of the Mexican Revolution derives entirely from the fact that Graham Gooch, the great England batsman and captain of the England cricket team, had a moustache that made him look like Zapata. And so his nickname was Zap.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that right? But you still see, of course, there are still the Zapatistas in the Chiapas, in the most southern state of Mexico, who basically run a lot of the state, actually, and have put up roadblocks, levy their own taxes, these guerrillas. And there's Emiliano Zapata graffiti everywhere, especially we went to Oaxaca. In Oaxaca, which is also in the south, you know, there are, you can buy loads of posters of Zapata. There are, he's on walls, all this kind of thing.
So it would be like Stanley Baldwin graffiti appearing on the streets of Birmingham.
Right. Go to New York and there's a mural of Calvin Coolidge.
Yes. That's great. I can never go back to Mexico.
Have you been banned for drugs offences?
No, I'll tell you why. So I've been once, and I went, the British Museum did an exhibition on Moctezuma.
Oh, wow.
And so what they do when they do their exhibitions is that they will invite journalists and people who can write up about, you know, on the subject in newspapers or whatever, to go with them on a publicity tour. So I got invited to go on that. And we were flown first class by Mexico Airlines.
Not even business class, first class.
And we stayed in the most amazing hotel, and they shut down all the museums, all the kind of the great museums in the middle of Mexico City. Neil McGregor, the director of the British Museum, and us. And we had a private tour by the director around both museums. Then we went and stayed out under the stars at Teotihuacan.
Amazing.
Ate roasted grasshoppers. It was wonderful. And I thought, this is how you do tourism. I can never come back because I will expect museums to be shut down given a private tour.
Well, what I'll say to buoy your spirits is that I found traveling in Mexico unbelievably easy compared with what I thought it would be. And I have to say, so for anybody listening who thinks, well, you're not murdered. I mean, everybody who I said I was going to said, I mean, including you.
Yeah, I was worried about you.
Don't get kidnapped by the cartels. Don't get murdered by drugs traffickers. Don't get this. I have to say there was absolutely none of that. And I found it incredibly easy. The museums are absolutely brilliant. So a big shout out, actually, not for the big museum that everybody knows, which is the Museum of Anthropology in Mexico City, which is on the standard of the Louvre or the British Museum or something. But there is a museum in Puebla. So some listeners who remember our last Emperor of Mexico podcast remember the great battle of Puebla against the French. There is a museum in Puebla called the Museo Amparo. And that, it's just been modernized. And that is a phenomenal museum of archaeology.
And what memories of the last emperor there?
None in the museum at all. So in Mexico City, you can go to Chapultepec Castle, which is where he, you know, one of the only purpose-built castles in the Americas. It's in the park. And there's a lot of kind of gilded stuff and... But actually, Maximilian, I think, is regarded as he's a comic interlude, because the big figure for them is Benito Juarez, who was the indigenous-born president who overthrew him.
Of course, because Ruskin's famous comment, wasn't it, that he would never visit North America because he couldn't contemplate a continent where there were no castles.
Yeah.
But actually, there is one.
Yeah,
so
there is one.
He could have gone. So he missed out.
There's Hearst Castle. That's in California, isn't it? So
I suppose not when Ruskin was.
No, maybe not. Exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway, enough of my holiday, Tom. That's unless you've got
Can
more.
I talk about my holiday?
Yes, because you've been very
glamorously.
Well,
it wasn't a holiday.
No.
So you've been to Mexico. I've been to Chatham.
Yeah, mad.
I think I mentioned this before. I'm walking the Saxon Shore Way, which is a national route. And I wasn't particularly looking forward to this stretch of it, because when I looked at the map, it was just kind of town. You know, there was no beautiful mud flats with interesting birds and the scene of prison hulks or anything like that to see. But it was one of the great days. So first of all, I would like to give a huge thank you to Paul Jackson, who is a Wang, an Athelstan. He does FIFA, the video game.
Does he? He makes it.
Yes, he was head of the company that made
Electronic
it.
Arts.
And now he's...
Wow.
Yeah, so now he's retired, and he's a trustee of the Royal Dockyards at Chatham, which any Dutch listeners will know all about, because the Dutch cheated in 1667, sneaking up the Medway, and burnt all the ships and carted off the Royal Charles, and disgracefully, the crest of arms is still in the Rijksmuseum.
It availed them naught in the long run, though, didn't it, Tom?
No, it availed them naught. So, in the long run. So have you been to the Royal Dockyards at Chatham?
I've never been. I don't go east or south of London.
They're amazing. So that whole thing we were saying when we were doing the Royal Navy and Trafalgar, those episodes, about how the dockyards are 19th century islands in 18th century seas. You absolutely get this. At the dockyards. You remember my animus against rope well. So the ropery, where they built the rope that went onto the ships, it's the longest brick building in Europe. How interesting is that?
Yeah, I have been here. I think I've been here for something to do with H.G. Wells. Was he involved in some way? Is he from that part of the world?
Don't think so. Maybe. I don't know.
Filming. I've been there filming, Tom.
Well, they film a lot of stuff there. They film Call the Midwife there.
You love Call the Midwife. Can't get enough of it.
I do love Call the Midwife. Well, I had Midwives and Nelson, because that's where the HMS Victory was built in dry dock. Anyway, but that was a kind of obvious place to visit. And Rochester also, which I'd never been to before, is also amazing. So the second oldest cathedral in England, founded in 604.
Dickens.
Perfect Norman castle. I mean, kind of amazing. The house where Miss Havisham is, you know, lives, the one that provides the model. Restoration House, where Charles II stayed, and where Rodhull and Emu then lived.
Is that so?
So Rodhull, for people who... overseas listeners who are under the age of 40, was a popular entertainer who had an emu who was a kind of glass puppet
real emu.
And would attack people. No, he wasn't a real emu. No, obviously not. But he treated him as though he's completely real, didn't he?
He did, yeah. So, he pretended that he wasn't in control of the emu, so the emu would attack interviewers and Rodhull would be trying to restrain the emu, but actually using the opportunity to harass Michael Parkinson.
So an amazing house. So Charles II, Pepys stayed there. Dickens associations and Rodhull. So fabulous. So that's all you'd kind of expect, that concentration of fascination and historical resonance in Rochester and in the dockyard. However, the revelation was the High Street that is initially Rochester High Street, and then it becomes Chatham High Street, and it kind of blurs. And that street, I would say, has to rank among one of the most historic streets in Britain. And the thing that's amazing about it is, if you had to nominate one of the great historic streets in Britain, Royal Mile or Whitehall or, I don't know, Oxford High Street, the thing about them is that they're not distinguished by people with tattoos and kebab shops, by and large. Actually, there are kebab shops on Oxford High Street, aren't there? But
Oxford High Street is rubbish these days.
Yeah. But I mean, it's kind of typified by grand architecture, by historical resonances, prime ministers, professors, kings, all that kind of thing. Chatham High Street, it's quite run down, I would say. But the concentration of history there is incredible, because you have an early medieval hospital, you have a synagogue, you have one pub where Nelson was a regular, another pub that was, I think, the first gay pub in Britain. There's a beautiful series of almshouses that were opened by the Queen Mother in their current form, but had been built, I think, in the early 18th century on the site of almshouses that had been founded by John Hawkins as a place for mariners and shipwrights back in the late 16th century. Hawkins, of course, buccaneering sea dog, who is also the founder of the Atlantic slave trade, the three-way Atlantic slave trade going from Africa, America, Bristol. Yeah, so the English. So unbelievably rich, and kind of all the more exciting because nobody there seemed to have any interest or consciousness of it at all. You know, it was
stare at you in suspicion and as you pass.
So this is, you know, the synagogue. And it's kind of shuttered up and nothing being made of it, but goes back to the 19th century, standing on the site of one that ultimately goes back to when the Jews returned to England in the 1660s. I mean, it's an amazing place. So I commend that to anyone who can get to Chatham High Street.
Rochester sticks out in my mind because Rochester was the place that Emily Thornbury took a photo of a white van outside a house flying the St. George's Cross and posted a mocking tweet about it, which led to her being sacked from Ed Miliband's shadow cabinet.
Well, as you see, if she'd gone to Chatham High Street,
she wouldn't have seen that. No.
No, well, she would have been enthused by the many historical resonances of it, connotations of it. So that was really great. The only blot, actually, on the day, Paul Jackson gave me a souvenir, which was an English translation of a Dutch comic book devoted to the Battle of the Medway, as the Dutch call it, where they come and sack Chatham.
Why would anyone translate such a book?
I don't know why they're selling it in...
Very strange.
Disgraceful.
So one thing we should do, talking about our international dimension, I know we have a lot of Australian listeners, and you mentioned Rodhull. It's been a very sad weekend, Tom, for the people of Australia, because they've lost Dame Edna Everidge, haven't they?
Yes, it has, yeah.
Well, Dame Edna was, I mean, Listen, I can't get enough of Dame
and Britain.
Edna. I think Dame Edna was brilliant. And actually, she had a Mexican dimension. A lot of Americans will know this because Dame Edna, who was a sort of drag act played by Barry Humphries, pretending to be an Australian housewife and megastar, international megastar, who would interview Roger Moore and Dennis Healy and people like that on TV. Dame Edna went to the United States at the turn of the 21st century. And there's a Mexican element to this because she got involved in a spat with Salma Hayek. Do you ever see this, Tom?
No.
Dame Edna was asked in something like GQ or Variety. There were a series of her tips for life. And one of them, she said, is don't ever bother learning Spanish. Because who are you going to talk to? The leaf blower, the person who cleans your bathroom. It's pointless. And Salma Hayek, who didn't realize that Dame Edna was a spoof, issued a statement on behalf of Hispanic Americans saying this was absolutely disgraceful and racist and all this kind of thing.
Oh, possums.
And Dame Edna then said, Salma is just jealous because she knows that I was the first choice to play Frida Kahlo in the biopic. But eventually I refused to do it because I wouldn't have a monobrow, but Salma wouldn't have that problem or something.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was, I'm a very mean-spirited person.
But
so
she was she was very equal opportunity when it came to being rude about people.
Oh yeah, she was incredibly
There's
rude.
There's an amazing sequence, amazing footage that got posted when after she died, showing her eviscerating Boris. Did you see that?
Yes, I saw that. Yeah, I saw that. It was very funny.
Very brutal.
Yeah.
And also Sir Les Paterson, the Australian cultural attaché.
That's right. Who,
extraordinarily dirty teeth and enormous.
My dad, I remember when I was growing up, my dad loved Les Paterson. I mean, he would basically, everything would have to stop if Les Paterson was going to be on TV because my dad just thought he was the funniest thing he'd ever seen.
But also, I mean, Barry Humphries was an amazingly civilized man.
Yeah.
Incredible wit, a bibliophile. I mean, he had about 400,000 rare books.
Yeah.
A great man. So rest in peace.
Australian listeners will be pleased to hear me say this. They're part of an amazing little generation of Australians. So Jermaine Greer, Clive James, Barry Humphries, they all kind of knew each other and they all moved at about the same time in the 1960s and 70s to Britain and became incredibly successful. Anyway, this is, we're in danger of doing a podcast being nice about Australians, which is absolutely not our... we're very much the Ian Botham of podcasts, aren't we, Tom?
Well, yeah, Ashes summer approaching. Absolutely. Anyway, we should just talk very briefly about the two episodes we did last week. So we had Katja Hoyer talking about East Germany, life behind the Iron Curtain.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So some people thought it was rose-tinted. Lurkio said it was rose-tinted. Thing about most people not being affected by the Stasi line sealed it for me. It seemed to miss the point of how such oppressive systems work. Obviously, most weren't affected as most obeyed. See, I would disagree with you, Lurkio. I agree with Sarah Carey, who replied to Lurkio on the Discord. And Sarah Carey said, I wouldn't call it rose-tinted. The fact is, Katya's point is it wasn't good. It was normal. I think it's not saying that the surveillance and the repression were, it's not making excuses for them or anything like that, but it's just saying most societies that have ever existed in history have involved a degree of repression, haven't they?
Yeah.
I mean, in East Germany, it was still better to be an East German in the 1970s than it would have been to be a German. Yeah, it's a better society than in the 1930s. It's more stable than the Weimar Republic in the 1920s. You're better off in East Berlin in 1972 than you would have been in Berlin in 1916 with immense rationing and the blockade. And so
probably
on.
Also better than being in the USSR.
Well, East Germany was the poster boy, wasn't it?
It was the richest.
It was the richest of the communist. Now, that's not to say, we think East Germany was great. But I think her point was people like her parents did make lives in East Germany that were stable and by their own lights, as weird as it would sound to us raised in the capitalist West, successful and maybe even contented. There were things they no doubt grumbled about, not having proper coffee, the fact that you knew your neighbors were spying on you. But I think it's one of the things we always have to say, there are no lessons of history, but one lesson from history is that people will just get on with things, even in the grimmest circumstances. And I think one thing that I found really striking about Katya's book is that basically, especially when the borders were closed, people just cracked on. They just got on with it and tried to make the best of it.
I'll tell you what gives a very accurate portrayal of life as a spy in East Germany, I don't know if you've seen it, is the Netflix series Cleo. Have you seen that?
No, I've never even heard of it, Tom.
It's absolutely brilliant. It involves Mrs. Honecker being chased in a bus through South America. It's really great. It's a kind of turbocharged James Bond with a female agent who's the daughter of East German spy master, who then gets betrayed by daddy and goes on the run. It's great fun. And I wanted to mention it to Katya, but reined myself in. As I also reined myself in, a comment from Wangbury, who very correctly notes that I think all Wangs will know that Tom did consider very briefly before discounting what would have been a very unsound move, imitating Katya's voice when he read her own account of watching a demonstration forming in East Berlin. Wangbury, you are correct. It did briefly cross my mind.
To do the German accent
as a four-year-old.
Oh my word, Tom, that would have been remarkable.
But I just thought, that would be disrespectful to Katya.
Yeah. But
and I'm all about respect on
it. And you don't think it was in any way disrespectful to read her own memoir out in your voice when she was present on the podcast. And she said, it was like I was in the room.
I thought that it lent a kind of intriguing postmodern frisson to the whole proceedings.
Okay. That's one way.
I think it's the first time I've ventriloquized someone who was actually on the on the podcast with us at the time.
I reasonably have expected to read from their own childhood reminiscences themselves.
No, I wasn't having any of that.
No.
Anyway, well, so that was all fun. And I thought also fun was history's greatest dogs.
Yeah, well, that was your idea. You initially wanted to do animals, and then you realized you'd bitten off more than you could chew.
No, it wasn't that. It was just that there were so many dogs that I couldn't choose.
Right.
One dog. So the idea was that we were going to do history's seven greatest animals. It was going to be a dog, a cat, bear, a pigeon.
Yeah,
a thylacine.
Another pigeon and more pigeons, and the rest is history.
Well, there are only so many animals that have actually played a part in history.
There must be some bears.
There is a bear, Wojtek.
Bears, a horse.
The Polish bear that served in the army at Monte Cassino.
Right.
And okay. He's very much on my mind because my Scottish estate used to go and swimming in the Tweed directly below it. Yeah, on a long chain, so he wouldn't just swim off. So I'd like to do him.
Yeah. I think we should stress that you're being slightly ironic when you talk about the Scottish estate. I don't want people to leave the Rest is History Club.
No.
Because they feel they're funding a sort of Grouse-more style lifestyle.
I had my first fly fishing lesson on Saturday.
How did it go?
I really enjoyed it. I got treated by Alex Preston.
Did you?
Of smuggling fame. Who, I didn't catch a fish because obviously I it's absolutely the thing I'd be hopeless at. But we had to stay till Alex caught a fish. So we were there for hours and hours and hours.
Do you not just stand there holding the rod and motionless?
You have to cast it. And right. The skill of casting, it's a bit like learning to bowl in cricket or something like that. It's an unnatural skill that takes a bit of time to master. But I like to think that by the end I had mastered it. But you have to develop fish awareness, Dominic. So you have to know, are they lurking deep underwater? Are they on the surface? What kind of fly should you use? Where should you cast your line? It's all very interesting. You have to think all the time.
All the time.
So I think that's actually why people recommend it for people who are a bit depressed, is that you go there and you commune with nature and you're having to think about fish all the time and flies. Rather than about your mortgage or whatever.
Okay. So fine.
So
anyway, we're not meant to be talking about fish. We're talking about dogs.
Yeah, so a lot of enthusiasm about Gellert. People who hadn't heard the story loved it. Welsh listeners were very keen, very glad that we'd included him. But correctly, people backed you in saying that it possibly wasn't entirely 100%.
This is what I wanted to hear.
Yes. Yeah. So Dan B93, Dom's right. The Gellert story is surely based on St. Ginfort, the Holy Greyhound. So that's right. Yeah, so that's a story in France where the Greyhound ends up becoming a saint. And actually, they had great dog stories in medieval France. Because there's another one that challenges a knight to a duel.
Dog does?
Yeah. So they have trial by combat. Because I think this knight kills the master of the dog. Right. And the dog is famously kind and generous and placid and never snarls at anyone. But he keeps snarling at this one knight. And so people draw the conclusion that he has, he's growling at this guy because he's the murderer of his master. And so it ends up with the king saying, well, they should fight. And the dog kills the knight. And before he dies, he confesses. So that's a good story.
That is a good story. That is an excellent story. So Beatus Briannus said whoever Beatus Briannus is, has always been touched by Roman dog epitaphs.
Yeah, they're great.
First time I read these, it actually brought me to tears. I thought this would be a good spot to share them. So Tom, do you want to pick a couple of your favourites from Beatus Briannus's?
So this is for Issa, and it name checked Tullus's great poem to Lesbia. Issa's more pert than Lesbia's sparrow love. Purer than kisses of a turtle dove, more sweet than 100 maidens rolled in one. Rarer than wealthy India's precious stone, she is the pet of Publius. Issa dear, she whines, a human voice you seem to hear. So that's very sweet.
Oh, crikey. How about this one? My eyes were wet with tears, our little dog, when I bore thee to the grave. So, Patricus, never again shall thou give me 1,000 kisses. Never canst thou be contentedly in my lap. In sadness have I buried thee, and thou deservest... And thou deservest. In a resting place of marble, I have put thee for all time by the side of my shade. In thy qualities, sagacious thou wert, like a human being. Ah me, what a loved companion have we lost. That's very moving, Tom.
Very, very moving.
The Romans, you're always down on the Romans. You see them as callous, brutal, pre-Christian hatchet men. And actually, they loved their dogs.
They did love their dogs. And also, in the Greek world in particular, they loved their pigs.
Did they?
And there's a wonderful epitaph to a pig that got run over by a cart. And it shows, it's complete with an illustration of the poor pig being run over. So I commend that as well. Also, what was enjoyed about this episode, Dominic, and Zep B speaks for many, many people. He says that this was a great episode, not least because Dominic called Hitler Nixon 4 whole times by mistake.
I know.
Just to balance that, Claire H., commends your admittedly very brief Nixon impersonation and says that you're hiding your light under a bushel.
Well, I think that's true. Generally on this podcast, people often say I hide my light under a bushel in this podcast. There's one thing that it's a big takeaway is my humility. So I had flown back from Mexico.
Do you want to just do another Nixon? Just do another bit of Nixon.
I am not a quitter.
Superb. I am not a crook. Say that. Go on.
I'm not a crook.
Brilliant.
I'm glad that's on
the record now. Oh, and Amy Mantrovaldi. Americans do indeed call dog biscuits dog biscuits.
Yeah, that's strange, but inconsistent, I think it's fair to say, because they also call scones biscuits, don't they?
Do they?
They do. If you have,
what?
When you have like...
Madness.
When you have breakfast in the United States, I think they have it a lot in the... Do they have them in the southern states? I don't know. I think you often see biscuits on the same kind of menu in which you would see grits. Have you ever had grits, Tom?
No, I haven't.
Grits I do not rate. It's just a sort of gruel. Mm. I think, but actually, American breakfast, no offense to our American listeners, don't leave the rest of this history club. Yeah, I think your breakfasts are rubbish. When you have bacon, it's not proper bacon. It's always too streaky. It's overcooked and it's clearly being created in some massive McDonald's style factory.
But they have it with maple syrup.
It's too sweet. Everything is too sweet.
Well, whatever. Listen, Dominic, we're going to lose all our American listeners.
Okay. I just have to do more Richard Nixon.
So Harold Stassen, talking on the topic of presidential dogs, let's spare a thought for poor little Beagle Johnson.
Yeah.
Who is always being picked up, LBJ is always picking him up by his ears.
LBJ was a very, LBJ would be a brilliant person to have on the podcast, but he was terrible, terrible. When to have on the podcast, he's dead. To talk about on the podcast.
Well, but you'd have to read those biographies of him, wouldn't you? And that's kind of 40,000.
A bit, I think it's fair to say a trifle too long. Yeah. I think those Robert Caro biographies. He was a terrible bully. So the other thing he would do, Tom, which I don't think would endear him to you, is if he had particularly kind of intellectual kind of aides who were quite buttoned up, particularly if he'd inherited them from John F. Kennedy or something, he wanted to humiliate them. He would call them in for a meeting, but he would be sitting on the toilet. Well, like Cato, yeah, actually, like Cato. The Roman. Yeah. He would be sitting on the toilet and they would have to sit on the edge of the bath or something and talk to him about gold or the Vietnam War while he was going about his ablutions. And they found that completely humiliating. And he did it on purpose to make them feel uncomfortable. Like Vladimir Putin with dogs. Actually, he did that with dogs, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Angela Merkel.
There might be an entire, you know, those business lessons from Matilda the Hun that people have. We could do a rest of history business lessons.
Business lessons from interactions with dogs. similar.
But also, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. LBJ on the toilet, all that kind of thing.
There's a great book in this, Tom. Somebody had commissioned a book about the rest is history.
If only. the other thing that's happening on the Discord.
Yeah.
What's going on? There's another SmackDown and they're doing empires. So I actually suggested that they, because they asked, what should we do? And I suggested that they do history podcasts.
Yeah, I said that.
Oh, did you?
I thought I suggested
well, I
that.
I did as well. We both yeah. did. Great minds obviously think alike. So they're doing empires, and yeah. I'm very intrigued by this because we wanted to do a World Cup on this, didn't we? Until
it was the idea of my friend John Tinker, a member of the Rest is History Club, who said, why don't you have a World Cup of empires, but basically not have any criteria, just let people yeah. choose their own criteria. So it's non-judgmental to see which wins.
I would love to do that. But Jack won't let us do it.
Well, he thinks he'd be cancelled for it, doesn't he?
No. So he thinks that World Cups don't work.
World Cups are a terrible waste of time. Yeah.
But it's a shame. But I'll be interested to see. I mean, I would back the Roman Empire, which I think is the classic empire. I mean, it's the original empire because it gives us yeah. the name. And yeah. the British Empire.
It's got to be a British-Roman final, hasn't it? I mean, the Ottomans are pretty good. I think the Ottomans are up there. The Mongols are very short-lived. I mean, the Mexican Empire, that doesn't really count as an empire. I mean, what are you going to put the Brazilian Empire in next?
Of course, the Persian Empire, we all know, is the most influential empire of the lot.
I think the semis would need to be Persia, Britain, Rome.
And the Umayyad Caliphate.
You think so?
Yeah.
Is that in there? Yes. The Umayyad Caliphate, or maybe the Spanish. The Spanish Empire is quite... But the Spanish Empire is rubbish, though. It's big, but it's unwieldy. And stagnant.
But I would guess the Romans against the British would be my... I don't know who'd win then.
It's a good final, isn't it?
Big good final, yeah. Connor points out that there might be three Roman empires, because there's also the Byzantine Empire and the Holy Roman Empire.
So it'd be sort of... Holy Roman Empire doesn't deserve to.
And then actually versus another Roman Empire, because the third or fourth Rome is Russia.
Where's the Emperor Alexander in this? Where's the Macedonian Empire? Very, very short-lived, to be fair. Tom, we've got to go because we've got to record a podcast about 1848, the Year of Revolutions.
We have.
It's massive, isn't it?
It's about 400, again. Yeah, about 800 yeah. pages.
Christopher Clark, Regius Professor of History at Cambridge, and himself, actually, a very good impersonator. So I wouldn't advise you impersonate because he's Australian. So I wouldn't advise, maybe you should introduce him in an Australian accent, see if he picks up on it, responds. Yeah, like a beverage. Exactly.
Les Patterson.
Exactly. We're doing that. Then we're going to Drury Lane and we're going to Edinburgh and Salford. Ahead are yes. live appearances in Dublin, Washington, New York City. And who knows, in the autumn, our paths may take us across the oceans to a far-flung corner of the world where we can pay our own respects to the ghost of Dame Edna.
Who can say? Who can say? Anyway, so lots to look forward to. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.